Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Labor Day marks the traditional kickoff of the political season, and this year in Ohio is no exception. With labor issues and the battle over issue 2 and Senate Bill 5 at the forefront. Joining us today to talk about the 3 statewide ballot issues in November, privatizing prisons, Ohio politics, you name it, is our regular panel of Statehouse reporters. Julie Carr-Smythe is the AP Statehouse correspondent. Julie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Also with us, Bill Cohen. He's correspondent for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Bill, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
And also, Bill Hershey, just to confuse everybody, Columbus Bureau correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. Welcome back, Bill.
Oh, thank you. Good to be here.
Let's just go ahead and get started with the ballot board. The ballot board has approved official arguments for and against the 3 state issues on the November 8th ballot. For the first time, the ballot includes a disclaimer, though, that none of the arguments have been checked or endorsed by elections officials. Republican State Senator and ballot board member Keith Faber explains the reasoning behind the disclaimer.
That would eliminate the possibility of anybody being confused that somehow we have validated the claims which may be false or misleading in some of these arguments.
I think that'll be the day when they eliminate the possibility of confusion.
Right.
I'm sorry. But will the disclaimer really eliminate confusion? I guess who has the greater advantage with this disclaimer? What's the deal?
Well, this is really just the disclaimer that the official arguments that both sides have submitted on all 3 of these issues, that these are just arguments and that the ballot board and elections officials haven't checked them out. This really is not on the ballot language. It's on the official arguments. A lot of Ohioans won't even read these arguments. These are arguments that will be published by the Secretary of State's office, distributed around, will be published in newspapers across the state. That's part of the state law, that arguments, not only the official ballot language, but arguments pro and con will be published, and they'll be on the websites and so forth. But a lot of people aren't even going to read them.
But why now?
Well, I think this just goes to how emotionally charged this particularly issue 2, Senate Bill 5 referendum is. And a lot of people are wanting to question, how do you truthfully characterize these things? And we have always in Ohio, as even Keith Faber notes in there, we've always allowed outside parties to phrase these things, and they have to be signed off on. But this, I think this and the health care overhaul, we've even as reporters been having a hard time figuring out on the health care overhaul, how do you accurately and in a balanced way say what this is or isn't going to do?
So Keith Faber was just using this kind of to take a shot at the unions and the folks who want people to vote no on state issue 2. He said, "Oh, I think their vote no arguments are misleading."
Because someone asked him for an example.
Forth. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so.
And let's not forget he's a lawyer.
Oh.
Senator Faber is a lawyer, and if we listen to his little cut there, he was speaking kind of like a lawyer. We don't want this or that to be misunderstood legalistically. But it doesn't take away from the apocalyptic nature of these arguments. They're still out there. And I think if you would ask a Democrat on the ballot board, he might have said the same thing in an opposite way about the arguments for keeping Senate Bill 5, because as Julie said, there hasn't been anything this highly charged in a long time.
And, you know, both of these 2 sides, if they wanted, they could put in their arguments issue 2 will cause a massive tax hike, or defeating it will cause a massive. They could say it'll make the sky turn green. And really, because of the way the state law is written, the ballot board and elections officials just have to let the 2 sides put whatever they want in their official argument, just like almost like a TV commercial. You can say virtually whatever you want
well,
in these TV ads.
Then what are they signing off on? Are they just checking for 300 words and typos?
Yes.
I mean, is that really
anything?
Any clerk could do that, but there's this stamp of approval, so it's not the good housekeeping.
And that's been understood really for years. I mean, Statehouse insiders.
Do you think average voters, though?
No. But they've been given arguments pro and con. And like I say, most people don't even read them.
Well, and it's interesting that the Attorney General has a official role in signing off on language that's used on the petitions. The Secretary of State has a specific role. And I think this was just a frustration on Keith Faber's part that they don't have an official role on this one. You know, the folks who want to overturn Senate Bill 5 got to say what they wanted, as Bill said.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with a panel of State House reporters today, Julie Carr-Smyth with Associated Press, Bill Cohen with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Bill Hershey with the Dayton Daily News. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I guess, you know, you got to wonder, listeners, if you want to call in and tell us, have you ever paid attention? What was your impression when you look at the arguments for and against ballot language on the ballots over the years? Have you thought that it must be true if it was okayed by the Secretary of State's office, or were you aware that it was just anything the one side wants to say in defense of their argument? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Now, there was another thing about the ballots, mailing out absentee ballots, and there was a compromise. Can we just mark this moment? and not after weeks of acrimony and anger.
I think this was stunning. I thought we were back in the days when people cooperated with each other. Secretary of State Husted, and I think his first name is Ed Fitzgerald, up there, Cuyahoga County executive, came to this agreement that next year, 2012, which is the big one, presidential race, Secretary of State Husted will use federal funds to send out absentee ballot applications to all Ohio voters. And Fitzgerald said he wouldn't try to do this two-step sidestep of Husted this year by having the county council in Cuyahoga County send out absentee ballots. And they had said some nasty things about each other beforehand. I think Husted called Fitzgerald a rogue or something like that. But this, it was almost like some of these people who got along with each other plopped into the State House for a day.
It was like the olden days. What happened, Julie? It was John Husted that capitulated, it sounds like.
It was, and I think in some ways Fitzgerald did as well, because we are mailing out the absentee ballot applications but not the absentee ballots. So that is a concession for Democrats, and there may have been legal questions about whether Cuyahoga County was going to be able to set a precedent there that other boards could follow in terms of going around this. But then the second thing was there was obviously political consequences. I think John Husted is trying to push through election reforms that he is fashioning as extremely balanced, moderate. He's really trying to drive himself out there as a moderate, and that he wanted to make sure that people didn't see him come off against the biggest Democratic county in the state as a villain.
I mean, that in and of itself is extremely unusual. Most Republicans are doing anything but trying to come off as a moderate. Bill Cohen?
Yeah, this is the third major decision in the last year, less than a year, that the Secretary of State has made that doesn't necessarily jibe with the most partisan GOP strategist's desire. So as Julie says, he is at least in those three instances, he's come off as a moderate and a compromiser.
And we should note that the two previous Secretary of States, fairly or not, were perceived as being more political. Secretary of State Ken Blackwell, 2004 presidential race, he was vilified by Democrats. He came out smiling. Secretary of State Bruner, a Democrat who bucked her own party to try to win the Senate nomination, tried to say she was on a straight and narrow course, but Republicans certainly didn't consider her to be treading that course. And as Bill said, Husted seems to be going right down the middle. I think he has his eye on, he wouldn't talk about this, but I think someday in later life he might want to be governor. And he knows there are lots of votes up in Cleveland, Cuyahoga County, and you don't want to alienate all those voters.
And in the short term, I think that he also wants to look like he came through on his campaign promise, which was, that was my Ohio accent there, campaign, on his campaign promise to not politicize the office, because he was really out there criticizing the Democrats last time around.
Okay, so let's go to state issue two. Let's just jump right head forward into the melee. Let's listen to the first television ad by opponents of State Issue 2, which aired across Ohio over the Labor Day weekend.
When there's an emergency, we need to be ready. We put our trust in our equipment, our training, and most of all, our fellow firefighters. But Issue 2 makes it illegal for us to negotiate for enough firefighters to do the job. Fewer firefighters means slower response times, and that can mean the difference between life and death. Issue 2 makes it harder for us to do our jobs, and that's not safe for us or the neighborhoods that we serve. When the call comes in, let's make sure Ohio firefighters are ready. Vote no on Issue 2.
Now, I was away this weekend, but I understand that this ran quite a bit across particularly the commercial television stations and the networks and around the network news and that sort of a thing. The other side, calling themselves the Building a Better Ohio campaign, issued the following statement in response to the television ad. Today, local communities are struggling to balance their budgets and hardworking safety personnel are being laid off across the state. Issue 2 would provide some reasonable reforms and give local officials more tools to get costs under control and keep more of these public servants on the job. We Are Ohio versus Building a Better Ohio. Confusing names, to be sure. Both sides claim what they want is best for Ohio, but they want exactly the different things. Wants to, Julie Smythe.
I think that the ad did exactly what we expected, which was to use firefighters first out of the box. They're the most sympathetic, especially right now around 9/11. And I know that the campaign We Are Ohio is saying we're not going to exploit 9/11, but certainly firefighters a week ahead of time wasn't a bad idea. It's a very approachable ad, kind of homey. With this guy, and I think that also just gets at what they think would be the biggest damage with it. So I think that it was a smart first ad for them, and I think that it's a good way to sort of capitalize on already being sort of ahead in the minds of the public right now.
It was a very sober ad. It didn't have firefighters jumping out of buildings or anything like that. One person I talked to was sort of underwhelmed by it, but the more I looked at it, I agree with Julie. It was a nice start, and I was interested in the response from Building a Better Ohio, and this will go back and forth, but I think it talked about communities laying off firefighters and police. Well, I thought that was why they wanted to have Senate Bill 5, so they could do all this. Now, We Are Ohio says cities and counties can already do these kinds of things. So I would expect that might be an argument they fire back with.
Yeah, I mean, whenever there's big budget cuts, you hear about the cities having to cut back on police and fire. That's the because that's one of the most expensive things that they do, is support those efforts.
But, of course, if the cities and schools, for example, can pay all these workers less and cut back their fringe benefits, they can have more of them on the job. Mm-hmm. So that's the argument from the Building a Better Ohio folks, the folks who want you to vote yes. They make their point. But, of course, if they don't have an ad on the air to make that point, well, they get a little bit of free news coverage on it in our news reports, but they don't get as strong an argument as the vote no folks.
Well, so Building a Better Ohio, what are they going to come out with? What is their plan? Do we know?
I don't actually know what their plan is yet, but I think that my guess would be that they're going to try to talk about equipping cities with the toolbox necessary to balance their budgets. I don't think they're going to go, but it's certainly looming out there, the kind of black and white union boss kind of forced union membership kind of argument. I don't think they're going to go there because of the sentiments of the average Ohioan on this issue right now, but I think they'll start out with the positives of providing those budget balancing tools. And interestingly, I was at my high school reunion this weekend speaking to a local firefighter, and he said in his firehouse, at least, it isn't a slam dunk for the vote no side.
Taxpayers are the heroes in the eyes of the vote yes folks in this thing, and the taxpayers are also the victims in their eyes. And I think they're going to be in some way trying to make this point that they've been making all along. This isn't really just not necessarily about cities and schools, but about taxpayers who pay the bill. So, I mean, I'm expecting to see some kind of vote yes ad where we have a very sympathetic taxpayer couple Who knows? They might even be police and fire people. They might be teachers. Who knows? But they'll be saying, you know, we've been struggling. Taxes are too high, and we need a break. And as Julie puts it, you know, Senate Bill 5 will give cities and schools the tools to keep down their expenses, and they'll be able to keep taxes down for us.
I don't think it's surprising that the opponents came out first. But Julie said, we don't know what the plan is for the supporters of Senate Bill 5. And there's this background argument that the business community that usually supports Republicans, well, these unions are not private sector unions. The supporters of Senate Bill 5 says it affects businesses anyway. But they're smart money people. I think they will put money out there. Whether they put out as much money as the opponents of Senate Bill 5, we have yet to determine that, because if they don't think that they have a fighting chance to keep Senate Bill 5, they're not going to spend as much.
And the most recent polls show they may not have a fighting chance, at least as of a month ago. The Quinnipiac poll, an independent poll with no axe to grind, showed, I think it was 56 to 32 Ohioans at that point were planning to vote no.
But it had narrowed at that point. I mean, any kind of narrowing is a good sign for the proponents.
But I think actually it was the opposite. I think the gap had actually widened some.
Okay.
Yeah, I think before the gap was 16 or 18 points, and now it was 24 points. And so even though those polls showed people do like some elements of Senate Bill 5, overall it was moving toward the vote no side even more. So as Bill says, some of these business folks and conservatives might want to pour money in, but they might say, why should we pour a lot of money in when we're going to lose?
We'll get back to this issue when we return with our panel of State House reporters. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your source for NPR news and local news. Stay up to date with issues impacting life in Central Ohio. The award-winning WOSU News team keeps you connected to the community, and the State House News Bureau has the latest in-depth coverage of state government. Listen to news from across the country and from our own backyard on 89.7 NPR News and streaming online at WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. 59 degrees and cloudy skies. Mostly cloudy throughout the day today with a chance of rain. Will reach a high of about 69 degrees. Rain is likely tonight, a low of 60, and more rain for Wednesday.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about Senate Bill 5 / Issue 2 on the ballot. If you vote against it, that means you will vote to have Senate Bill 5 repealed. If you vote for it, Senate Bill 5 stands in all, in every aspect of it. Now, we were just talking off the air about where the funding's coming for the different campaigns. We Are Ohio, which is largely the union-backed organization, they have to report where their contributions come from, but Building a Better Ohio doesn't. What's the difference?
I think it has to do with, one is the, when you mount a campaign for the ballot, you become a reportable committee. So it is their committee, We Are Ohio, that is behind the ballot issue. So, but opponents can form different kinds. I'm going to leap into some IRS stuff that I might not be exactly right on, but I think 501c3s and 4s only have limited amount of reporting that they have to do. They've promised, as we were all discussing, they have promised that they're going to tell us where it's coming from. And it's, you know, it's not a leap to think the support is coming from some of these groups we're already seeing come out to endorse them, the manufacturers, the chamber, that kind of thing.
But it's interesting, the Dayton Area Chamber of Commerce has endorsed Senate Bill 5, but I was speaking to one of their officials, and they made clear they hadn't, I think he said, hadn't given any money yet. So I don't know if that's true about the Ohio Chamber of Commerce or these major metro area chambers of commerce, but they need money. I think the unions will have $20 million, more than that maybe, to do what they want to.
Yeah, AFL-CIO has already come into the state and said they anticipate that they're going to be in double digits. And at least one person I talked to sort of behind the scenes, and I've been putting in my stories, says they think it'll be at least as expensive as the last governor's race, which was $33 million.
Yeah, I've heard one person, pairs of people said it could be $40 million on both sides. This is life or death for the unions, because the public employee unions are really the last bastion of strength for labor unions in the United States. So if they lose this, they're going to be sort of social clubs almost. They won't really have too much influence.
And I think we're expecting that, you know, millions of dollars are going to flow in from outside Ohio, because if you're a conservative somewhere else, you go, oh, my gosh, we've got to make Ohio an example. And if you're a liberal somewhere else, you got to, oh, we got to make Ohio an example and not let them push unions around. So we're going to, I think we're expecting that we're going to hear these charges. Oh, you guys have a bunch of outsiders coming in. Yeah, well, so do you. So,
you mentioned at the outset, Julie, that this is a very even-handed, and Bill Hershey, even-handed, the first one out of the box from We Are Ohio, very even-handed, calm, cool, and collected. It probably won't stay that way. Am I making a leap there? Julie?
I think it probably won't. The only question I have in my mind is that how do you personalize this? You know, certainly on the We Are Ohio side, they might personalize it by attacking Governor Kasich, but he actually, this wasn't his bill, and he did sign it, obviously, and he has said these things that have gotten him in lots of hot water. I'm going to break the backs of the unions. He called a police officer an idiot in a personal anecdote, but it's certainly everywhere on the internet. So those kind of things will probably come out in some of the later ads.
It wasn't his bill, but I remember very vividly the first hearing on this bill in the Senate Finance Room. Governor Kasich came through a side door just to show his support for Senator Shannon Jones. So I don't think that you can distance him from that. This is John Kasich. I mean, it didn't come as may have come sooner than he wanted it to. But this is what he's never supported, public employee collective bargaining. So I think that at some point they might make it an anti-Kasich ad.
Do you hear about any regrets out there? Now, the unions were not going to negotiate unless they repealed Senate Bill 5, and they were absolutely not going to do that. It's too late now. It's going on the ballot. But any regrets out there that you hear from Republicans and backers of the bill that maybe they went too far in including the firefighters and the police?
Well, I mean, we've actually seen some folks departing the state Senate who supported it, who I don't know that they had regrets, but they certainly didn't think they could get reelected. Jimmy Stewart, Karen Gilmore. And I think that those were considered weakened positions because they were, at least in Jimmy Stewart's district down in eastern Ohio, there were hate ads out on him and billboards and that kind of thing.
I don't think Republicans will say we regret overreaching.
That's why I wanted to say, do you hear it behind the scenes?
Right. They won't say that, but I mean, look, in hardball politics, you don't offer to compromise usually unless you feel like you're coming from a position of weakness. Usually if you've got all the votes and you've got the strength and you think you're going to win, there's no reason for you to offer to compromise. And in this instance, it's the Republicans offering to compromise.
And they made – well, I think the – offers maybe started before this, but Republicans have been doing focus groups. They have an idea of what people are thinking. And I thought the timing was kind of weird, at least the public. I mean, the horse was out of the barn as far as the cliche goes. The bill's out there. It's been passed and signed by the governor. How do you compromise now? You usually negotiate before something happens.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest today, Bill Hershey, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News and the Columbus Bureau. Also, Julie Carr-Smythe with the Associated Press State House Bureau. And Bill Cohen is a correspondent for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us as well at allsides@wosu.org. And Jim, in West Columbus. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I've got a question. What is the union membership in the state? Is it in the municipals? Is it mostly police and fire, or is it mostly bureaucrats?
Teachers?
Teachers too. But what about aren't the office workers and all the bureaucratic workers, aren't they unionized? Middle management unionized in Columbus?
Bill Hershey? You know the makeup?
Julie maybe has more precise.
Yeah, I know 350,000 public workers
altogether.
Statewide. At the municipal level, the ones you have to remember other than the safety forces are, sanitation workers, maintenance people. As far as middle managers, I think that might be a bit of a patchwork. I think in some cases they are, and that would be a guess on my part, though.
But teachers are a big part of the public employee union
and school
membership.
Employees.
Sure, but they're
on.
Not at the city. I don't know if you were asking about city employees.
I think he was asking about all employees that would be covered by
right.
Senate Bill
so
5.
So it is fire, police, teachers, school nurses, and sanitation workers, all the paper pushers, if you want to call them that, at the state government level, the bureaucrats, but not the managers, I don't think.
Jim, thanks for that call. Let's move on. There was a surprise announcement about prison privatization in Ohio. The state will sell just one prison, state prison, and outsource management of another instead of selling five prisons as originally possible. Annette Chambers-Smith, she's the deputy director of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, explains the change in plans.
We thought that we would need to sell all five of them to net $50 million. And in fact, we got a price of $72.7 million on only one property.
So how surprising was this? And if you're for privatization, if you think private interests can run something like a prison better than the state, and you can get $72 million for one prison, why not sell them all if you can? Julie?
It was very surprising. And I think that it was interesting on so many levels. On one level, of course, the administration had talked really tough about privatization, and they were being workers at these prisons, who are also public workers, by the way, were demonstrating around the state and that kind of thing. So it was fascinating that not only did they not sell all five, but they took back one, so they deprivatized one, so they'll have actually more.
That had been being managed.
Right. And so they are going to now have two that are publicly managed, two that are privately managed, and then this fifth one that's going to be owned and operated, the first in the country. So that was really interesting. But the bottom line, I think, was that some of the opponents of this were correct, that the market was very bad and that essentially they didn't get the bids they hoped they would get, and it wasn't a good deal for the state.
But they got more money for the one than they expected, right?
Well, they emphasized that, but they had on paper that they were going to get $200 million. They only needed $50 million.
Yeah, that was right. That was the number when it started. Can they go back and sell them again or a year from now, or does it take?
They can, but what Annette said at the press conference was, no, our director has no further plans to sell these at this time. They will get to reopen negotiations, I think, every 2 years, every budget, on whether they like what's going on with their contracts.
You know, when they can sell a prison for $72, it makes you think, even short of the $200 million, think, wow, there's a lot of money in the private corrections business. There must be.
Yeah.
Gary Moore, the director of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, was not in on this press conference because he is a former employee, former director at Corrections Corporation of America, a private prison operation. But he did talk about other plans that he has for prisons coming up and how the prisons are being operated and how he wants to get prisoners back into society in a more functional, productive way.
Well, and this was interesting in doing interviews on this contract decision, because we do have a bill that's moved through that is trying to shrink Ohio's prison population. But what those who have watched the private industry are saying is there's now a profit motive on the part of a private prison operator to increase the population of their prison. You'll notice that even though we're trying to shrink the prisons, I think we added 700 to 1,000 beds in this move. So why are we adding beds if we're shrinking our prison population?
And ultimately, they talk about more job training and that sort of thing, and for lesser offenders, more opportunity to work outside of the prison gates and that kind of thing. But ultimately, the bottom line is when you have a felony on your record and you're in a bad job climate and you have 700 people applying for one position, you're going to pick the person probably who doesn't have the felony on their record. Isn't that the ultimate scarlet letter? The F?
I think it could be, unless you want to circulate petitions. Or
well, prisons, they're always with us, death and taxes. State Issue 3, if it passes, would allow Ohioans to opt out of the requirement to purchase health insurance under the federal health care law. But opponents argue the constitutional amendment would impact more than the federal law. Let's listen to Jeff Longstreth with the Ohioans for Healthcare Freedom speaking in favor of the Issue 3 amendment.
Well, that's the great thing about drafting a very simple, very easy-to-read amendment. It says right in the ballot language that, and this is an exact quote, it will affect no laws or rules that were in effect as of March 19, 2010.
Now, the question is, what will be the real impact of Issue 3 as a constitutional amendment? Maurice Thompson, head of the 1851 Center, it's a conservative constitutional law center that drafted the legislation, said his group intends to have its amendment affect other laws in Ohio beyond the new federal law. This is a quote from Maurice Thompson. Their argument is pretty ironic because we've been saying all along that this is intended to have a greater effect in order to lower costs and create more health care freedom. We are attempting to draw a line in the sand and say that the federal government shouldn't get any further in between doctors and patients. So what is it?
Well, I think they want to draw a line in the sand semantically and philosophically. Legally, I don't know that they really can affect this. I mean, this is an issue that's in the courts. This is an issue that's in the Constitution.
Constitutional experts with whom you speak, even some conservatives, say that a state law or state constitutional amendment cannot affect or override federal law. And that's what the debate's about. But this argument's going on in so many different areas right now. Ohio's part of a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the health care overhaul. And one of the arguments that the supporters of the amendment make is, well, let's pass it and maybe we'll be the vehicle for some challenge to it. One thing is clear, it would prohibit Ohio, as Massachusetts did, from enacting a mandate that all people have health care coverage. So it doesn't impact just a federal overhaul, it would impact the state as well, and local governments if they want to do something like this.
The fact that the people who want you to vote no on Issue 3, the fact that they didn't come out with one of their first things being, oh, we think the federal mandate to buy health insurance is good because it helps provide some other things here. The fact that they didn't zero in on that, I think, may give you a clue as to the fact that they feel that they may be in trouble on that particular front. In fact, the Quinnipiac poll, I think, did show by more than a 2-to-1 margin, yeah, Ohioans don't like this federal mandate. Now, when asked whether they were going to vote for the exemption, it was pretty much 50-50. But by more than 2-to-1, they don't like this federal mandate. So that puts the vote no people in a tough position. And here they were, instead of fighting on that battlefield, Innovation Ohio, the liberal group that staged this news conference, they said, well, let's set that aside for a second. Let's talk about some other things. We think this bill is going to go too far and interfere with all sorts of other things, trying to take, I think, people's minds away from that federal mandate. Yeah.
The question of the mandate and how it'll affect – Bill, I just want to be real clear. This may not have any effect because it has to do with federal law, but it will affect state law. In the process, even though it may not change what happens at the federal level ostensibly, we don't know yet, there's arguments going on, it would change no matter what happens at the state level.
Yes, and if you don't think that is important to people who don't like mandates, ask Mitt Romney about this. That's Romney Care up in Massachusetts requires people to have health insurance in that state. Ohio couldn't do that if this were enacted here.
But since the time that Romney Care has passed, we have the federal law. So it's kind of I'm not a lawyer, but it does seem to me that this federal law now applies in all 50 states. We've had one court in Ohio that's upheld it. And so I think that is not a huge question for us in Ohio for the secondary reason that it would take an all-Democratic legislature to even pass such a thing in the state, which we haven't had in generations.
1984, I think they were.
And even though the Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor continues to go around the state trashing the Federal Health Care Reform Act, the state is going through the motions and establishing the different bureaucracies that they have to at the state level to put
healthcare exchanges.
The healthcare
and so
exchanges,
forth.
Right. So they
yeah,
are
and even
forward.
Kasich has said he's not going to necessarily block any of that. But it is interesting that you mention our Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor is going around doing this.
Just this weekend again.
Those of us who are political observers might say that they put this issue on the ballot in a convenient year alongside this Senate Bill 5 issue for the reason of driving turnout when you're talking about the fact that even Jeff Longstreth is saying it's not necessarily going to have an impact.
We're going to take another break. My guests, Julie Carr-Smythe with the Associated Press State House Bureau, also Bill Cohen, a correspondent for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Bill Hershey with the Columbus Bureau for the Dayton Daily News. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about state government and politics. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your all-day NPR news station. Listen to local and national news all day, every day. And you can hear the best in classical music on Classical 101. Listen to your favorite composers 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. It's 89.7 NPR News and Classical 101 from WOSU Public Media. For more information, visit WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes, beginning at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides has gardening tips for the fall with Ohio's garden sage, Deborah Kanapke. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11. And Wednesday night, NOVA presents an epic story of engineering, innovation, and the human spirit. Engineering Ground Zero follows the five-year construction of One World Trade Center and the National September 11th Memorial and Museum. NOVA captures the struggles of architects and engineers to make the building safe under pressures of a tight schedule and the public's expectations of a fitting site for national remembrance. Watch NOVA, Engineering Ground Zero, Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV. And it's 59 degrees with cloudy skies. There is a chance of rain today and a high of 69. Showers are likely tonight, a low of 60 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. I have a State House panel of reporters, Bill Hershey from the Dayton Daily News, Bill Cohen from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Julie Carr-Smythe with the Associated Press State House Bureau. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if you want. You can do that, or you can tweet me at Ann Fisher WOSU. There's many modes of communication at your beck and call. We were talking during the break, as we often do, and about the fact that this is an off year. Off years usually aren't this busy or exciting. And Bill, you made the point that it's good because often people don't have time to focus on these kinds of issues.
Yeah, sometimes during a presidential election year or a gubernatorial election year, there are also controversial ballot issues. And it's frustrating for me because we're trying to cover candidates, we're trying to cover the issues, the voters are being deluged, we're being deluged with information and, you know, propaganda from all these candidates and issues. At least this time, the voters can focus pretty much, except there is some local candidates, yes, but no statewide candidates, no presidential. All we're dealing with basically two very controversial ballot issues statewide and one more low-key issue number one, having to do with judges' retirement age. But this way we can all focus, the reporters and the voters.
And it makes a difference, too, in how the election is run. Julie made a good point. I think there is some suspicion that issue three was put on to get out conservative voters who would therefore want to uphold Senate Bill 5 and vote yes. The last time Ohio had a union issue like this was 1958. You know, I wasn't even a reporter then. But that was a state election year. So people were coming out to vote for governor and all the statewide offices. This kind of an election, that Bill said, with just issues on, gives supporters and opponents a much better opportunity to target their voters and get them out because you know the turnout is going to be lower. So the side that does the best job getting the vote out is going to win, literally. And that's what I think concerns some of the supporters of Senate Bill 5, because for the opponents, it's life or death. And for the supporters, they'll still be able to come to work tomorrow.
It's going to be, typically it's a lower turnout for the off-year election, but are we expecting a bigger turnout than usual because of Senate Bill 5 / Issue 2?
I would assume so because, I mean, organized labor is just that. They're pretty organized. They're trying to mobilize everybody that they know and every. And I was trying to find, I don't know if you all have been able to find the statistic, but union households in the state are much more than just union members. So if you have a spouse or a union member in there, that's a pretty high percentage, maybe 17%. So those houses will be maybe affected. And we've seen not only the public employee unions get involved here, but the private sector unions as well.
David, you're listening to us from California. Welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Yeah, hey, morning. I was just going through my list of states that are trying to create a national ID or some kind of an ID so that people can't vote unless they're carrying ID. I see Ohio's not on that list, so I'm, you know, urging you to keep away from that dirty mess. But I wanted to ask you all to go into details. In other words, you've got a lot of listeners out there that are hearing this idea that people are going to be urged not to vote. You know, there are huge media campaigns by the people that hate America. They hate democracy enough to make people divided enough so they tell them not to vote. And that is so un-American. Now, I wanted you all to go into details and tell people what are these tricks that they're using, what are the techniques that they're using.
Okay. Has anyone heard about anybody saying don't vote?
I think maybe what he's speaking about is that there's some discussion that a photo ID requirement in a state will discourage voting and will keep certain people who don't have IDs from voting. Mm-hmm. And he's exactly right. We aren't going that route, at least at this time. I think even if we passed a bill now, it wouldn't be in effect this year.
And also the elections overhaul bill that could be subject to a referendum would provide for fewer days of absentee voting. I think I don't know. It's 35 now, and how many would it be?
Right. I think it shrinks it. I can't remember, but maybe to about 20.
So,
by about a week. David from California, thanks for listening. Thanks for that call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Wanted to return to the earlier discussion about the recent compromise between Secretary Husted and the people in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. So he said he would mail out absentee ballots to everyone in 2012. Is there a legal requirement that he do that when 2012?
In other words, could he change his mind?
Could he change his mine, or could the funds dry up or something like that that would prevent him from doing that?
I think that's a point. I mean, it might be sort of a gentleman's agreement at this point.
It's not a law, and I was wondering, they went to great lengths to say that Senate President Niehaus and House Speaker Batchelder were on board with this. He did say that they would use Help America Vote Act federal money to do these mailings, and these are not absentee ballots, as I understand it. They're applications for absentee ballots.
Correct.
Am I right?
Correct, and that is a key element of the compromise, is that I believe that Ed Fitzgerald's initial idea was to mail the ballots themselves, with the idea that in his county, it is helpful in terms of reducing lines and that kind of thing in big urban counties to have as many people vote absentee as possible.
But I think the caller made a good point. This was an act of faith on each side.
Kind of like the deal with the Humane Society of America.
Yes, yes.
Which fell through. Thanks, Dan, for that call. Bill in New Carlisle, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi, Bill.
Well, I was interested to know if anybody else is getting their salaries cut or their retirement cut, like the governor or people in the Board of Education or anybody else that's working for the government, except for the workers.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we were just talking about an article in Plunderbund, blog that the actually high-ranking state senate employees all got pretty hefty raises. So does anybody have any?
Well, we know the legislators aren't getting their salaries cut. There were bills proposed to reduce their salaries, and they didn't get anywhere.
Right, they were trying to do that, and they didn't. If I recall correctly, they thought that it was not proper for them to change their salary while they're sitting in office, which I think is in our Constitution.
They can't do that anyway.
Yeah,
it would have
can't.
Only changed it for future legislators,
right.
Legislatures.
So it would just have been symbolic until the next legislative session. Bill, thanks for that call. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. And Delbert in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. What I'd like to say is that I would like for the news media perhaps to get out the truth about, is the bill good for the country or is it not good for the country?
Which bill?
The health care bill.
Oh.
The one that they want to recall or make changes to.
Right.
Because I think people are not quite informed as to what the bill is really going to do or what it's not going to do. Because in my mind, that is the one program that the government can pay for that all Americans could share in equally, from the richest Americans to the poorest Americans. Not like farm subsidies or welfare. Everybody would be able to participate and get some benefits out of the health care field.
I guess the issue is not whether they'll be able to participate, but the fact that they would be forced to participate. Anyone want to jump in?
Well, I do think, as Bill Cohen has said, it is going to be actually a good time for the media to work on explaining these issues, because we have two major issues, and I think part of our job will be pure education. What is in these bills? What isn't in these bills? And in the case of the federal law, we'll be able to look somewhat at impacts because it's already been in place for a little bit of time.
The folks who are defending the federal health care law and the mandate, I think, agree with this caller. And one of their points is, okay, you may not love the mandate, but it's the keystone. It's the foundation for all the other, what they consider, positive reforms in this federal health care law. For instance, the part that says if you've got a pre-existing medical condition, you know, right now you have a hard time getting insurance. But under this national law, well, you'd be able to get insurance. So these other parts that say your 25-year-old adult child can stay on the family's health insurance for a couple more years. They say that's another provision that is made available because everyone's going to have health insurance. So I think the people who want the voters to vote no on issue 3 probably agree with this caller a lot.
But the timing is everything in politics, and one of the problems with the supporters of the health care overhaul is not all the benefits took effect immediately. And so far, not everybody realizes what these impacts have been. Bill pointed out a couple good ones, but over time, maybe more people will come to embrace it. But they haven't had a chance to digest all these so-called positive things yet.
Well, and there's this issue in terms of timing that those who are most motivated to educate about the positives are the Obama White House, and they're busy saving every penny they can for next year. So they don't have a lot of money to come out and use to defend it.
I have an email from Gary, wants to talk about prison privatization again. He says, regarding privatization of prisons, what, if any, safeguards are in place to prevent those non-government private companies from exploiting prisoners? For instance, could a company hire out prisoners as labor and pocket the profits, or can they start charging money to folks who want to visit prisoners, like New York will start doing shortly? I don't know about New York, but are there any kind of rules and regulations, Julie?
Our understanding at the news conference was that the contracts require these prisons to operate with all the same safeguards that the state already has in place in terms of safety, reporting, and that kind of thing. I'm not sure on your specific question, but I do know that they said they're putting additional auditors in place so that they can go into these prisons and make sure that everything is going the way that it's supposed to go.
So how do private prison companies make money?
They, in this case, the part of the contract deal was they pay for the prison or they pay to operate it, and then they are receiving a per diem every day for every inmate that's in there from the state. So the taxpayers are still paying for the prison, incarceration.
But they make money because it costs them less to provide the services and the food and whatever else they provide to the prisoners. Then they get paid by the state, and then that's their. I don't know what
that's
profit
where the profit
is,
but they're paying. It's the personnel costs are less. They don't have unionized employees anymore, right?
Right. Some of it is from what we're hearing from the union. Some of it is pure wage and benefits. Some of it is the scale that some of these prison companies are operating on that they can.
They have economies of scale. Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you very much for joining us, Julie Carr Smythe. Appreciate you being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Julie Carr Smythe, she's with the Associated Press at their State House Bureau, and also Bill Hershey. Bill, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
Bill Hershey's Columbus Bureau correspondent for the Dayton Daily News, and Bill Cohen, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Bill Cohen, he's correspondent for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks to all of you out there for your calls, your emails, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.